GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. 1 year ago next month, Donald Trump won. From day one of his campaign at Trump Tower until today, his relationship with the press has been combative. He accuses the media of spreading fake news and unleashes personal insults to some of them. Last week, he said he wants the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee to investigate media companies he alleges make up stories. I recently hosted a panel discussion on how journalism has changed in the time of the Trump administration. It was presented by the Columbia Journalism Review, Emory University political science professor Andra Gillespie, Washington Post media writer Eric Wimple, and Jonathan Peters, a press freedom scholar at the University of Georgia, joined me. Here's a portion of that conversation. I want to take us back, since we're talking about how Donald Trump has changed journalism, and some of that occurred before he was president. Fair? Right? So I want to take us back to the campaign, the beginning of the campaign. And let's start with talking about the extra security needed at rallies and how his rallies were very different from those most journalists were used to covering. Eric, do you want to talk about that first?
Sure. I mean, after the campaign had concluded up at Harvard, they had that always the wrap-up, and they had, you know, the CNN guy, Jeff Zucker, they had AP, Kathleen Carroll, and one of the things they all said was that we spent more resources on security than we ever had, and a lot of it related to covering these rallies, which were very frequent and at which Donald Trump would call out specific reporters like Little Katie for Katie Tour, and he would focus the attention of the crowd on the media pen, saying that they weren't doing their job properly. And of course, we all remember, this requires no expertise whatsoever, we all remember they don't cover the whole crowd, they don't do the wide shot. And so there was significant concern among news organizations that people would be assaulted, people would be hassled, and so on and so forth. Put on top of that the anti-Semitic backlash on Twitter, where lots of journalists who covered Trump or who wrote critically of Trump received anti-Semitic threats on Twitter, as well as over the phone. And so all of a sudden you see news organizations having rent-a-cops walking around the newsroom and really beefing up the forces at these rallies and also doing a hell of a lot of training on how to respond to threats and so on and so forth. So the business of journalism has merged a little bit with the business of private security in ways that it had never done. And it continues to this day, especially, you know, Trump continues to need this jolt that he gets from the rallies. And of course, a staple of these rallies is bashing the media. And for Donald Trump, it can't get too personal. And for his minions, it cannot get too personal. There are so many examples. I'll shut up there. But I could go on.
Well, then, Jonathan, let's talk about what effect that has or has not had on press freedom. I mean, some might say that this could squelch a newsroom's organization. What if they don't have the resources to have the private security? And NPR had training that was similar to sending reporters into a war zone. So how does that affect freedom of the press?
Sure. I think the first observation that I would make that I made in a column for CJR a few months ago is that I am increasingly convinced that, to quote Lord Varys from Game of Thrones, that Donald Trump would be happy to see this country burn as long as he could be king of the ashes. And, you know, where better to start the fire than the First Amendment?
Why is the First Amendment, do you think, the easy target? Why is that the low-hanging fruit?
I think it chums his base. It scores points so far. Many of the people who have parroted the rhetoric that Donald Trump has used have been rewarded for doing so. A few months ago, the Committee to Protect Journalists and the Freedom of the Press Foundation partnered to create a new website called the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker. It is an ambitious website. CJR is a partner of it. So are 20-some other press freedom and nonprofit journalism-related organizations. And the ambition of the project is to document nationwide every incident of abuse of a reporter and arrest of reporters for conducting journalism. So far in 2017 alone, we've documented 23 arrests and 25 physical assaults. Of those, the The majority have taken place at protest. A half dozen were at the Dakota Access Pipeline Project. A number of others were at the inauguration protest of Trump's inauguration. And most recently, at the Smith-Stockley protest in St. Louis. So, you know, to put a point on this, I think the concern that I have, born from Trump's rhetoric, is the normalizing effect that it has on these types of arrests and abuses of journalists. And, you know, as I can get into a little bit later, we already are seeing state and local government officials parroting the rhetoric that Trump has used.
Greg Gianforte.
That's right. Greg Gianforte is a terrific example. There was a Republican lawmaker in Tennessee who called the local newspaper fake news because it reported accurately a story about his efforts to roll back a traffic cam law because he himself had been convicted under the traffic cam law a number of times. And so these are unfortunately the trends that we're seeing, and I worry about the normalizing effect of the rhetoric.
Then, Andra, let's move on to some of the subject matters which are having to be addressed by major news organizations that possibly have not had to be addressed in this way. And let's start with race, but also gender. I mean, obviously, Donald Trump has made political correspondents who have not had to talk about some issues have to talk about some issues and do creative bleeps to discuss some things, but that also comes up with race. And I would argue that we're having to talk about race in a way that journalists have not really had to address it before, even under the Obama administration. What do you think about that?
So if we go back to 2008, the discourse was about this notion of post-race, that the idea that an African-American could successfully run for president was going to tear down one of the highest and hardest glass ceilings.
Did you say post-race?
Post-race. So we were always talking about how America was becoming post-racial, the fact that people could kind of get beyond America's racial history to elect an African-American president was a sign of progress, and it certainly was a sign of progress. What we did not anticipate, and history taught us this, there were people who wrote about this extensively before 2008, was that moments of civil rights progress are often met with backlash, and behold your backlash. This is something that you could see with the emergence of the Tea Party, where there's a lot of empirical evidence that would suggest that some adherents to Tea Party ideologies also espouse racially resentful points of view that are informing their political behaviors and attitudes on specific issues. And then it also manifests itself in the election of Donald Trump, where people were motivated not just by disgust with Washington and anti-elitism and concerns about globalism, but it's also couched in othering. So whether we're othering people abroad or we're othering people here, race is very much at the subtext of this. What's really interesting is that, you know, you think about that day in June 2015 when Donald Trump descends the escalator. It seems like a big publicity stunt. And I think most people assumed on that day that when he starts off by maligning Mexicans, that that's the end of his campaign and that all this is a political
stunt. Yeah, but how many times do people say this is the end of his campaign?
Right, and the reason why is that there's empirical evidence prior to this that would suggest that in an America that was becoming increasingly, at least on the surface, racially tolerant, that folks would discount overtly racist messages. And I think what's been so shocking and what somebody like me who's not a journalist but has to study this is trying to figure out is all of the data and all of the evidence that suggested that people would discount overtly racist messages because you don't want to be perceived as racist, how did Trump kind of slip in the middle?
That's political science professor Andra Gillespie of Emory. We also heard from Washington Post media writer Eric Wemple and Jonathan Peters, a press freedom scholar at the University of Georgia. We'll have more of that conversation just ahead. It's on Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This hour, we feature a panel discussion I hosted for the Columbia Journalism Review. The topic, Media in the Age of Trump. I was joined before a live audience in Atlanta by Emory University professor Andra Gillespie, Jonathan Peters, a press freedom scholar at the University of Georgia, and Washington Post media writer Eric Wemple. I asked Eric if it's ever okay to label someone racist.
I've called Donald Trump a racist in my columns. We have in our opinions column at the Washington Post. Dana Milbank last year did a piece titled Donald Trump is a Bigot and a Racist. I believe the facts are there for this this deduction, this analysis. I mean, look, media all the time draws analytic conclusions about people. If you support, you know, cutting taxes on the rich and letting the letting the money trickle down from entrepreneurs to lower classes, we might call that person the supply sider, right?
Right.
If, you know, Bernie Sanders says we want single payer, we want to nationalize healthcare, we might call Bernie Sanders a socialist.
Right.
You know, if someone says I want to put a wall up, I want to close the borders, we might call that person an immigration hardliner. If someone says Obama was born in Kenya, you know, the Central Park Five needs to be put to death, you know, take your pick, Mexicans are rapists. You know, the white supremacists are fine people. And so I do think that there is just too much evidence out there that Donald Trump is a racist. And, you know, I think that it becomes a question. That doesn't mean you can't be fair to Donald Trump. But I do think that there is something to be said for taking facts and making deductions.
Right. So this brings us to the question of fact-checking, which is a unique challenge for journalists. I have never had to make so many decisions about fact-checking, things that are just, I don't know that I've ever had to deal with somebody just blatantly repeating an untruth that is so easily disproven. That's difficult for me as a journalist. And so I wonder, especially when it comes to like our views of not only press freedom, but a journalist's responsibility to the public, the role that we play, how do we grapple with that? What about that has changed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is something that I've been thinking a lot about in the last, I would say, 2 years in my specific area of specialty, First Amendment law, because you know I've seen so many misstatements made about what the First Amendment does, what it doesn't do, what it is supposed to do, its role in a democratic society. And we've seen for decades now low public understanding of First Amendment rights. And even putting aside the most recent survey to come out on that issue, it was about 2 weeks ago. It's got some methodological problems to it, but ignoring that when looking at other, you know, more sound surveys, you know, the majority of Americans can't name one of the First Amendment rights. And so, to the extent that we want to get serious about exercising our rights under the First Amendment, including the right to report critically on the president, the White House, to engage in fact-checking, I think that as a threshold matter, we need to understand the nature of the rights that we are exercising, what they enable us to do, what they don't enable us to do. And so, when Trump comes out and says something like, I'm going to change the libel laws, and I'm going to make it easier to sue news organizations and win big money, I think we need to fact check him on that, because the president does not have that kind of constitutional authority. This is basic eighth grade civics, whereby most libel law exists at the state level. It is checked by federal constitutional principles enumerated by the First Amendment. And so the president's best way to change First Amendment law, if he wants to do that, including those in the area of libel, would be to appoint judges who share his views of libel and the First Amendment. But otherwise, there is no direct route to doing that.
So, Andra, let's move on to another thing that has changed, which relates to pretty much everything that we've been talking about so far, which is how do we take the president's Twitter feed. How are we to cover the Twitter feed, especially so often when people from the White House administration completely contradict what the president says in Twitter? Is that official or is it not official?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, there's a legal issue about this, about whether or not the president's private
right.
Twitter account, is going to be archived. And I think at this point, it pretty much has to be archived. But then there's also how presidents communicate directly to the public. And so it was noted 30 years ago in observing Ronald Reagan that Reagan often took to prime time to make public addresses to the nation when Congress was obstructing whatever his legislative plan was. And so he would get on TV, interrupt the 9 p.m. television show and ask you to support a bill that Congress was kind of holding up. And so we call that notion going public. And so it's part of the president's bully pulpit. And we've seen that over time as technology has changed, that presidents use whatever is the current mode of communication to reach directly to the people. It helps to humanize them. It helps to make them seem responsive. And it can be an end run to put extra pressure on Congress to go along with the president's agenda. In that respect, the use of Twitter as a tool to go public is actually, you know, a part of this long tradition of innovation in the United States in technology. I think the issue was the content of the tweets. And whether or not the president is behaving presidentially in making the comments that he makes. And I think for journalists, this is a really hard call when he starts engaging in juvenile and sophomoric behavior, like the NFL tweets, for instance.
Or insulting the leader of another nation.
Right, so there are two questions. So when he's engaging in the sophomoric behavior, should that go to the top of the news cycle? And some people would argue that anything the president does is newsworthy, and so therefore it must be covered. And this is also additional evidence to try to figure out where the president's bigotries and biases are. And then it becomes a question of, is it appropriate for the president to be executing foreign policy via Twitter by, you know, insulting other countries or trying to put pressure on China via Twitter? You know, is Twitter the right realm to engage in that type of behavior? My personal opinion is no, that you need to use the diplomatic kind of apparatus and that it's there for a reason. But part of the reason why Trump, I think, does this is that he always said that he was coming in to be a change agent. And so he thinks that, well, he's just going to do things differently and he doesn't have to follow norms and customs. And so I've been thinking a lot about this in terms of jazz. And so I'm not saying that people were, you know, that Washington was perfect and that it didn't need to be cleaned up. But there's a difference in coming in and purporting to play jazz when all you know how to play is chopsticks. And that's a lot of what I see here. Like, there's a reason why institutions have evolved and developed the way that they have. There's a reason why there are certain rules and processes and norms. And if you want to improvise and deviate, that's fine. But you got to know the rules first before you can improvise. And I think that's the problem.
That's Andra Gillespie, Emory University political science professor. We also heard from Washington Post media writer Eric Wemple and Jonathan Peters, who teaches press freedom at the University of Georgia. Just ahead, more of this conversation. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. This hour, excerpts from a panel I led about journalism in the age of the Trump administration. We were joined by a live audience here in Atlanta, the Columbia Journalism Review hosted. My panelists were Emory University political science professor Andra Gillespie, Jonathan Peters, a press freedom scholar at the University of Georgia, and Washington Post media writer Eric Wemple. President Trump's soapbox is often Twitter. We talked about Twitter's role in media coverage.
So Eric and Jonathan, let's stay with Twitter for just a second because it brings up so many issues. And Jonathan, let me go to you first in talking about the legalities of using that and whether or not there's actually a whole Twitter feed that then moves every tweet that Donald Trump sends into official White House language that says a statement from the president, right? So what do you think about the legalities of that as an official archive?
Mm-hmm. So the Presidential Records Act makes clear that the president's tweets need to be archived in some way. There's a question about the extent of the archiving right now, how the White House actually, if at all, is doing that.
Because he's deleted tweets.
That's right. He has deleted tweets. He has blocked users. He has specifically blocked users. This was stipulated to this week or last week in a lawsuit that is ongoing led by the Knight Institute of the First Amendment at Columbia University that is suing for the, well, so the claim is that President Trump's Twitter feed is a public forum. Right. And you cannot regulate based on viewpoint in a public forum. Which would mean that when he blocks a user because he dislikes what the user is saying to him, he is engaging in viewpoint-based discrimination of speech, which would be a First Amendment violation. So I think you've got dueling First Amendment banjos here. You know, one is the legal obligation on the part of the White House to archive tweets, even those that are deleted. A deleted tweet, to the extent that he is allowed to delete a tweet, the deletion does not remove the obligation to archive it. And then on the other hand, you know, does the president have the right to block a user because of viewpoint? That's at issue. I would argue no, that would be a First Amendment violation.
But Eric, then how do we make decisions as burnt journalists? Because we have been accused of allowing the president to play us, right? To use inflammatory tweets to distract us from possibly more meaty policy issues. How do we make these decisions on whether to cover a tweet or not cover a tweet?
I laugh because I've heard that, you know, the distraction argument is really widespread now. Every time Trump makes some ridiculous tweet, it's like, he's distracting us from the Russian investigation, he's distracting us from, you know, climate change. I thought there may have been something about that until the time I was watching on CNN. I always have all the cable channels going all day long.
Oh my God.
I was watching on CNN in the morning. This was back in the campaign. Jason Miller was on television to, I think it was during the transition maybe, to talk up a few of the appointees and how these Trump appointees were so great. And then Chris Cuomo is on there and says, oh, well, the president just tweeted about this other ridiculous thing. What do you have to say about that? And Jason Miller is like, not interested in talking about tweets today. I want to talk about these great appointments that we have for the Trump. And, but Cuomo said, but what about this ridiculous issue that President Trump just tweeted? I really need you to tell me, you know, whether this reflects his thinking or is just some random thought. Chris, I'd like to stick to the topic I came to talk about today, which is President Trump's great appointees. So like, you know, he outfoxes his own self. So I think that, you know, positing some sort of distractionary theory attributes way too much strategic discipline and calculation to an operation that runs entirely on idiocy. I mean, I don't see how you can stick with that.
And you can fact check that, because it's been confirmed that Rex Tillerson called the president a nasty name. Since we're talking about how he has changed journalism, we have to grapple with the blurred lines between journalism at this point and politics and entertainment. Here we are in a moment in which one of the more powerful political voices is Jimmy Kimmel. For good or ill, that's the truth. Andre, you want to weigh in here?
So I think I have three points to think about here. And if we talk about the blurring of lines, I mean, Trump is more of a manifestation of something that had happened all along. And so I think it's important to think about news organizations as businesses and as corporations and profit, and thinking about how news has been packaged in recent years in order to try to appeal to as broad an audience as possible. And so part of that is a function of us reflecting on ourselves as individual citizens about how we take our knowledge in, about how much news we actually want to consume. Do we want to deal with hard facts? Do we want long, drawn-out stories where we get lots of information? Or do we want it in nice sound bites? And so part of this has to do with changing, you know, the news cycle, especially on television, where you've got to fill more hours so you have more arguing and other kinds of things. But I think we all have to recognize that, one, there's a civics deficit in this country that allows people to not know what their institutions are supposed to do and not supposed to do, that allows them to perhaps be led astray in some instances. And then there is a demand that we place on news organizations as businesses to entertain. As well as inform, and that also might actually end up influencing how news is covered. So, you know, I think people are very reflective of the campaign and allowing Donald Trump to get as much earned media as he did, like, you know, showing right. rallies from start to finish and other types of things. And so I'm sure in 2020 people will rethink that for whoever the candidates are. But, you know, as somebody who confesses to watching a lot of trashy television and trying to figure out how to sort of redeem my trashy TV habits, it's actually been really instructive to understand what reality TV looks like to help understand the president. And so while I think that there are some serious problems with President Trump's fixation with media coverage, just knowing that he gets a file of crayons every day just doesn't make any sense to me at all. That's and nobody false. Should be,
right.
you know, should be governing their lives that way. You know, I think part of the reason why he is weathering the criticism is because he thinks it's good for business, because on his TV shows, that was good for business. Right.
That's Emory University political science professor Andre Gillespie, also Jonathan Peters, who teaches press freedom at the University of Georgia, and Eric Wemple, the media writer for The Washington Post. We'll hear more of this conversation in just a moment. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. All this hour, we've heard a panel discussion I moderated for a live audience here in Atlanta. The topic, how journalism has changed since the election of Donald Trump. My three panelists included Emory University political science professor Andre Gillespie, Washington Post media writer Eric Wemple, and Jonathan Peters, a press freedom scholar at the University of Georgia. As we wrapped up our discussion, we took some questions from the audience.
Hi, I graduated Columbia J School in 72, had a long career, and now I teach journalism at Clark Atlanta University. But after the year that changed journalism, I'm in a quandary. What do we tell students? Do we tell them what we learned, what we did, or is this a whole new era? Where do we go from here for these young people?
You mean to try to make them not run away from journalism?
How to do it.
How to do it.
One thing I would say, and you know, I think the session and your leadership of it has been great, and I think the title is right on. But I think that one thing hasn't changed, which is that the core mission and the core job of journalists, which is to report, 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 and then publish your findings to the best of your ability, remains very much a pretty good model. And I would cite, and this is one of the things where Trump has changed journalism and where journalism has remained static at the same time. Washington Post, earlier this year, I forget exactly what story it was, but they were like writing up their stories. You know how these stories used to go. Like, after consulting several sources and the administration, we have concluded this, that, and the other thing.
Right.
And the Washington Post did a story after interviewing 30 sources.
Oh my God.
You know, in the White House, the administration, and in New Zealand, or you know, whatever. That's a little exaggerated. But you know, 30 sources to nail down a story. And one of the reasons this is, and I interviewed Maggie Haberman in the New York Times about this, is that she said, you know, this is February or March. You know, you could talk to one administration official who was telling you what they believe to be the aversion events, and then you talk to another one who's also soberly trying to give you the, and they're 180 degrees diametrically opposed. So the point is that journalism, its core practices, has never been tested more than it is under this administration. You have to get more sources, more, you know, backup, more documentation than ever you have before. And if you screw it up, you are done for. You know, they will put out press releases, you know, the fake news, Breitbart will come out against you. You live a miserable life if you screw up.
Don't tell them that last.
But high stakes, high rewards.
And I'll just say, you know, as somebody who's in contact daily with students, I have a position in the Grady College of Journalism at UGA and an appointment in the School of Law there. So this, I think, goes to the point that Eric made about politics pervading all areas of life and breaking down boundaries. You know, politics is entering the classroom. I mean, it's been in the classroom for a long time, I guess. You know, it's entering the classroom in a more visible way than it had before. But it's creating cool opportunities for me because students are asking me a lot more questions than they used to about what they're reading in the news. They are more engaged, at least to my eye, than they were in the past. So it's actually created a lot of amazing opportunities to show them where the rubber hits the road. You know, when a student says during our section on libel, you know, what are the powers of the president to change libel law? Or, you know, can the president block Twitter followers for viewpoint-related reasons? And in the more routine journalism classes, news writing, information gathering, media ethics, I'm seeing a ton of energy and interest, and not in a partisan way. It's not the students coming in, you know, saying, you know, let's go get them. It's how in the hell do I do the kind of journalism that the Washington Post does, or that, you know, the New York Times does. And so I guess I am not worried now. I'm kind of inspired.
I want to get to everybody's questions, and there's a lot of them. Over here, question.
Would you comment on Facebook as an outlet for journalism? And Jonathan, particularly, can we expect, should we have more regulation with respect to...
Yeah, so the vast majority of Americans now get their news from Facebook.
True, yes. So to the latter point, should we regulate social media more than we do? I've written two law review articles about that in the last year. And the first one was looking at the question, does the First Amendment have any role to play in governing these private actors in the way that they intermediate speech? The major problem here is a constitutional principle. It's a doctrine called the state action doctrine, which says that you enjoy rights under the Bill of Rights against the government and against government actors, not against private actors. So if Facebook makes a decision to block you, to disable your account, do you have any First Amendment recourse against Facebook? No, you don't. So what I did, I looked at a bunch of different conceptions of the state action doctrine, held them up to the light to see if there is any role for the First Amendment to play in this area at all. No matter how you hold it up to the light, one reason or the other, there is no role to play. So then you say, well, could Congress pass a law that would in some way dictate to Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and so on, you know, what Rebecca McKinnon, who is an internet scholar, once called the sovereigns of cyberspace. Could you constrain their activities in some way? And the very First Amendment that would not aid us in regulating them actually provides the freedom for those platforms to make choices about the speech that they host, the users who come onto their platforms, and the conditions that they have to satisfy in order to use those platforms.
I mean, I think this is an interesting question. So we know what consumption patterns are.
Sure. I want to get to these last.
But we also want to think about Facebook as a platform versus Facebook as a news organization.
Right, exactly.
Right?
And it is not.
It's not a news organization.
Right.
But a lot of people don't know that because our civics education is bad. And so when something comes on your Facebook feed from Uncle Bob, unless it's Uncle Bob Woodward, you should probably go verify it. Like, and people aren't disciplined enough to do that. So this starts, you know, very young, where you teach people, no, you have to pay attention to real news. No, you can't be cheap. You need a subscription to a newspaper. No, not everybody's opinion is equally weighted. You need to see who's actually done their homework about issues. And no, don't get it off of InfoWars, because, like, that's made up.
That is Washington Post media writer Eric Wemple, Jonathan Peters, a press freedom scholar at the University of Georgia, and Emory University political science professor Andra Gillespie. That panel was organized by the Columbia Journalism Review, and you can hear the entire discussion at gpbnews.org.